We'll start our conversations with a son's eye view of how his father came to start the Shenandoah Valley Bach Festival 21 years ago this summer. The father is Ken Nafziger, the festival's artistic director, and the son is writer Jeremy Nafziger.
When I was four or five years old, we lived in Germany for a year while Dad studied with the premier Bach specialists in the world. And so Bach was always the thing. And,
who was?
That was Helmut Rilling. And after that, you know, Bach concerts were always more important concerts than other concerts for his choirs, I think. At some point when I was in high school, Dad got a call sort of out of the blue from someone in North Central Washington, kind of way out there, not all the way to Spokane, but out by a big lake in the middle of Washington. Was a retired professor who had decided to start a Bach festival there, you know, without much, just sort of decided to, and asked if he wanted to come conduct it. So he went out there and kept going every year for a long time. He doesn't go there anymore, but that was sort of the idea that led to the one here. And my mom said, well, why don't we have one here so you don't have to go all the way out there? And a couple people who were on the faculty at EMU at the time had ties to that area in Washington too, which was complete coincidence. And they went a few times to play in that one and also thought we should have one here.
Now, Ken Nafziger's own view of the very beginning of the Shenandoah Valley Bach Festival.
I had been doing a Bach Festival similar to the one that's here now out in central Washington for a good number of years. And one year at the end of the summer, there were a number of people at a dinner party.
And here? Where?
In Harrisonburg.
In Harrisonburg.
And Joe Lapp, who was then the president of EMU, I wasn't aware of it at the time, but he was obviously sitting there taking notes on everything I said, because somebody asked me, what's this festival like? And so I was just answering their questions informally, wasn't making any presentation of any kind. And after the conversation subsided, he looked at me and he said, so what would it take to get one going like that here? And we gave him some information, specific information, and then he said, let me think about it. And in January of that year, he said to us, let's go with it. To Scott, my colleague, and his wife, Marcia, and my wife, Helen, and me, he said, let's do it this summer. Well, January to June is not a very long lead time.
Let me stop you for a minute. When you gave him specific information, mm-hmm. what kinds of things did you say it would take to make a Bach festival happen in Harrisonburg, Virginia, which is not exactly the music mecca
right.
of the universe?
Right. Well, we said that in contrast to the festival out in central Washington, where people who wanted to play had so few opportunities to play that they would do it without being paid. We all said that won't happen here because there are a lot of places where people go to play and they always get paid. And so if it's a freebie, if it's a donation here, they won't do it. They simply won't do it.
You're talking about musicians,
yeah.
professional musicians.
Right, right. In addition to that, sort of when this initially came up, there were people who lived in Harrisonburg who were always going off to play in D.C. or Richmond or Roanoke or elsewhere. And their complaint was that there's never a place to do for their own community what they do for everybody else. And so the two things sort of fit together. And we told Joe Lapp that it would, of course, require a significant investment of money to pay these people to come and play. And he was fine with it. He said, let's do it. And so we scrambled for
a few months. Now back to this not much lead time between January and festival time.
Well, it meant inventing a schedule, inventing plans for rehearsal, coming up with a repertoire, coming up with advertising plans, marketing plans. I mean, everything was all from scratch. There was nothing that we had to go on.
And no magic wand.
No magic wand.
So how'd you pull it off? What was the first thing you did?
Well, finding a date was critical because a lot of people in the area who would be involved in something like this were also involved in summer festivals elsewhere. And the time we picked, which is sort of right after the high school graduations and before people's summer vacations begin and before other festivals around the country begin, was a perfect slot to put it. And that's essentially where it stayed. It ended on Father's Day on the first year, and it ends on Father's Day every year. So finding a date that would work was the first thing to do. And then for my colleague, Scott, he concerned himself with what would be a minimal amount of money that we could pay people that they would be attracted to coming anyway. And what I was working on was, what will we play? You know, what's manageable in with the resources that we might have and would be of interest to the audience that we would draw. And so that all of those things were going on simultaneously, and we eventually got all those things in place, invited musicians, assembled a choir, and did it.
Just do it.
Lived
school.
More or less happily ever after.
I'm interested in why Bach.
For me and a lot of other musicians, I think Bach is a kind of critical core figure to the whole history of music, that there is something in my mind that's kind of universal about him in a way that's not the same for everybody else. And the way I would describe this is, if you imagine the person of Bach as a complete circle, you can do this with any composer, the idea of a circle. And part of the circle is the craft, knowing how to write music in a way that works and lasts, the sheer beauty, what's beautiful about it that attracts people, and what's the aesthetic or the spiritual context for the music. And to me, Bach is maybe the only, or at least one of the very few circles who's perfect. That there are gaps in, you know, I think, well, I'm not going to name names because I'll offend somebody, but...
Oh, I don't care.
No. But there are gaps in the works. You know, Mozart, for example, writes beautiful stuff, but it can be pretty shallow. Some of it's, fortunately, not very shallow, and so it keeps attracting people. But with Bach, his sacred music, his orchestral music, all of it has this same unity of these three aspects that I think are important to a musical composition. And then I'm intrigued with the idea that everybody seems to find something to do with Bach. There is bluegrass Bach, there is jazz Bach, there is Japanese Koto Bach, there is Brazilian Bach, there is African Bach, there's everything Bach. And so that he's again the only one who has that kind of appeal to all music, no matter who's playing it. One of the most profound performances I've ever heard of a Bach, one of the Bach Brandenburg concertos, was done by the McLean family band, a bluegrass family band out of Kentucky. I don't think they're in existence anymore, but they played this at a conference I attended, and I couldn't believe it. And what was most amazing about it was that none of them read music, and they heard this piece on the way home from a gig they had played, and they just fell silent and were mesmerized by the whole thing. And when it was finished, they said, "That's the most beautiful conversation we ever heard." And so they learned it by ear. And that's a lot of notes to learn by ear.
Yeah.
And but what I got from that, not only was the fact that Bach found a home among bluegrass musicians, but their comment that it was the most beautiful conversation they had ever heard. I think that's become, again, one of the chief characteristics of the music of Bach, that it is a conversation within the piece itself, with the performers, singers, the players, everybody, but also has miraculous ways of engaging the audience, and not everybody does that either. So I'll have to soon invent a circle with four sides.
Ken was talking about but it is a bluegrass Brandenburg. Looking back to the first Just Do It Bach Festival and the Bach Festival we're about to have, what's changed?
Oh, it's huge. It's gotten more expensive because the intentions are, it's that way with everything. You know, anything that is successful breeds the expectation that the next year will do something different. And so there's always this sense that whatever we did this year, no matter how good it was, is a benchmark, and what we do next time needs to exceed that in some way.
Are you okay with that?
Yeah, I'm fine with that. No, I would rather have it that way. I would rather not settle into a routine where you don't have to think about it. I wouldn't do it if it was that.
So what's different?
This time?
Yeah.
Well, what's different this time is kind of a repetition of a pattern that I started from the beginning, and that is that it was my intention when we did the second Bach Festival and the third and the fourth and up to the 20th, which we've done now, that nobody who attends this year's Bach Festival should ever have the option of saying, well, I was at the Bach Festival last year, I heard it. And so something significant always changes. There's always Bach, and it's always in comparison or in unity with somebody else. And this year, the unity happens to be with two composers who are having birthdays this year, anniversaries this year. Verdi, whose 200th anniversary of his birth is this year, and Benjamin Britten, whose 100th anniversary is this year, and they both did a lot of opera. And so I went with the idea of drama as the unifying factor between Bach and these two people. So the big work is the Verdi Requiem, which is as dramatic as a work ever gets, including opera. And because there are a lot of opera fans in the community, one half of one of the programs is going to be Verdi opera arias and ensemble pieces. And the Bach part of the drama is carried out mostly in the opening concert, where the program is made up of a style of music called a concerto grosso. And that's a Baroque thing, and it means basically there's a large group of instruments playing in contrast to a smaller group of instruments. And so the drama comes in changing the sound, changing the color, changing all the things that happen just because you have large and you have small. How many ways can you change the small to make it differently? How many ways can you change the large to make it sound differently? So the drama is an internal musical drama, not a story drama like an opera would be or the Verdi Requiem would be.
Did you have the program set?
A year ago.
Mm-hmm. You're working a year ahead now.
Well, actually, 2 years. What came with the increasing number of years that we've done this, what came along with that was that in order to get the artists, the solo artists we wanted, we had to engage them as far as 2 years in advance, sometimes even longer.
What's your rehearsal schedule?
Brutal.
Good. That makes it fun.
Yeah. Nobody has met until this coming weekend, mm-hmm. and we have our first concert on Sunday. So that Friday night is the first time anybody has been together. The choir also comes on Friday night for the first time in preparation for the Verdi Requiem. And so for those 10 days, there is the glorious and simultaneously terrifying experience of being able to do only music and nothing else. There is no time for a committee meeting, no time for all kinds of other things that intrude on life on a regular schedule. And it's a glorious way to live, but you couldn't do that forever. You know, for 10 days in the summer, not 10 years summer, but 10 days in the summer, you can do that and find great pleasure. And it becomes a sort of personal marker for what is the human being capable of doing. what am I capable of doing in 10
it's
in
extreme
10 days?
Music,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. And it's a good measuring stick, because if you can do it, it's great. And if you can't, we all suffer. And there is something exhilarating and healing about doing music that intensively that you don't get when rehearsals are spread out over a long period of time. And I think it's good for everybody. Everybody's exhausted by the end of the 10 days in a very good way, spent in a very good way. And so it's a good thing. But again, you couldn't do that forever.
How do you feel when it's over?
The first day after it's all over is usually you feeling like, well, this could have gone on one more day. But the second day, everything just crashes. And that's when you start putting the music back on the shelf. And that's when it hits you. But yeah, it is over. And it's like sending your kid away to boarding school or something, you know, where you're taking something that's been a very important part of you, putting it back on the shelf and saying, it's next chapter.
This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Rehearsals for the 21st annual Shenandoah Valley Bach Festival are just beginning at Eastern Mennonite University. Here's some more of the conversations I had with Bach Festival founder Ken Nafsinger and his son, Jeremy. Jeremy goes first. Tell me about your dad. and music.
Okay. No, music is what he does. It's always been what he does, and he does it better than anyone I know. I have trouble singing in other people's choirs, partly because he's my dad and partly because he's better at it than a lot of other people.
And why?
There's something in the rhythms of the rehearsal where he lets you sing a lot. He doesn't stop and talk a lot about things. When he does talk, if you would keep counting through those things, through those pauses, when he starts again, it's the same beat. it's like it's somewhere in the back of his head.
He has a fabulous ingrown.
Yeah, there's something. He didn't. He grew up in Ohio, in not a particularly musical family, and without a lot of direction in that way. But it just caught his. Caught his interest and talents at the same time, and that's what he did.
And I want to talk just a bit about you and music. I know from your son that you didn't grow up in a musical family. He right about that?
He's right. Mm-hmm.
So where'd all this come from?
Well, I grew up singing in church all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was clearly an important part of my background. I grew up on a farm. And
in where?
Ohio, northwestern Ohio. And farmers, at least the way my father farmed back in those days, with doing a little bit of everything and not a lot of mechanization like many of them have available now. Farmers didn't have time to do music because in the summer there was outdoors work to do. And I always knew that I didn't want to be a farmer. When I was a kid, I dreamed up these plans for how I could turn my father's farm into a resort, a vacation resort. Never happened. But I didn't have any interest. And actually, the way I got into music was that in my junior year in high school, I had a wonderful choir director who said he wanted to start sessions for people who might be interested in learning how to conduct the choir. And I volunteered. There were, I think, five or six of us.
Why'd you volunteer?
I don't know. It just came out of somewhere. And it turned out that I really, really enjoyed it. And he left at the end of my junior year, and I was afraid that that was going to be the end. And he said, no, I'll pass along to my successor that you're interested in doing this again next year, which he did. And the first day that I met her in a study hall, I introduced myself and she said, oh, you're the one who's interested in going on in music. And the truth of the matter is it had never occurred to me before to make a college degree out of music. But I said, yes. And so apparently I just can't go back on my word. So that's how I got here.
Sounds as though it hadn't occurred to you that this could be a career. Where'd that come from?
Well, I think if it's in there to begin with, it will find its way out, which is what happened with me. My parents both sang in church. My dad was always whistling. I mean, he was always whistling. Hear him all over the farm whistling. And my mom had a real thing for beauty as well, you know, the way she canned and preserved foods in the summertime and the way she served meals and the way she kept her house, had a real eye for beauty and quality and all those things. And so I think that there, well, even with my father's way of doing farm work well, I think those habits of doing whatever you're doing intentionally and completely and throwing your whole self at it was as useful a gift as anything they could have given me.
I asked Ken Nafzinger if he had any closing statement he'd like to make about the Shenandoah Valley Bach Festival.
I'm always amazed at how many people in the immediate area don't know that this exists after 20-some years. People do drive for long distances to attend this, but many people who live right next door aren't aware, and I don't know how to fix that problem. But I think to me, the education part of a festival like this lies in getting people to pay attention to something like this who may have thought they'd never be interested. So we have the noon concerts, which by intention don't have ticket, you don't sell tickets for, so that there is no excuse for anyone to say, well, I can't afford anything.
They're glorious, too, if
thanks,
I can editorialize.
Thanks. I think they are, too. They're just amazing because it really demonstrates the quality of the people we have in that orchestra, which explains why the orchestra is as fine as it is.
And it's much more energizing than just a sandwich.
Yeah, that's good. Also, we never mind if guests want to come in to listen to rehearsals. They can sit in on rehearsals, leave when they need to, and they go on morning, noon, afternoon, and night, so there's always something going on campus.
Now, that's something I didn't know.
Yeah.
That's good to know. I love rehearsals.
Yeah, no, rehearsing is, to me, the most fun.
There's more. Les Hellmuth, who's a musician at heart, even if he doesn't earn his living that way, has not only sung in almost every Bach Festival choir, but he's been the cantor for almost all the Sunday morning services.
Cantor is the one in the worship service on Sunday morning that connects some of the dots for the service. It may be an introduction to scripture reading. It may be an introduction to the homily. So there's a greeting. It's actually written text. It's like a welcome, but instead of it being spoken, it's sung.
Does it have a tune, or is it more like recitative?
It's more like recitative. It's basically one pitch that falls off the end just a little bit and then raises back up again. It's sung text, but it's on a single tone.
What interested you about trying this?
Ken asked me, actually. It was that simple. I mean, he called me one day and he said, I need somebody to decanter on Sunday morning. Would you be interested in doing it? And I said, yeah, I've never done it, but, you know, what's involved? And so he sent me the worship service. He always picks the texts. Sometimes it's in Latin. Sometimes it's been in Italian, German, English. So I've done all of those. And every service is just a little bit different. But there is one text that I could at least illustrate for you if you would like.
I would.
It's the blessing at the end of the service, and it's the same blessing year in and year out, and it goes like this. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you and give you peace.
Obviously, your faith is important,
mm-hmm.
and you can sing. How are those connected for you?
I think they're inseparable for me. The expression of my faith, pr- probably comes as much through my music as it does through what I do day in and day out. Those connections are, even for music that is not expressly religious, there is a way of interpreting the music that brings life and hope or expresses human condition in ways that not too many other expressions can do. Poetry can do it, the spoken word can do it, but something happens when music enters the body and the ear that nothing else, this is my opinion, of course, but nothing else transcends the human spirit in the same way as what music does. Because it takes more than just sound, but if you take it to its fullest extent, soul, sound, the muscles of the body, all of it comes into play in the creation of sound, in the creation of music.
You'll find a link to the Shenandoah Valley Bach Festival on the Spark page at WMRA.org. And just in case you're interested, Airplay, Sunday at 7 on WEMC and Tuesday at 7 on WMRA, will be the first half of the Bach B Minor Mass and the chorale Sleepers Awake, also by Bach, both from the 2012 Shenandoah Valley Bach Festival.